May it please the Court. Nicole Walker on behalf of the appellant, Tyrone Miles. There are three reversible errors in this case. The first is that the state was permitted to usurp the jury's power by introducing the opinions of Detective Richardson as to the credibility of Mr. Miles, the strength of the state's case, and the facts of the case. Additionally, the state was permitted, without laying a proper foundation, to introduce an interpretive narrative of what a witness purportedly told the officer out of court. And finally, the state was permitted to introduce a statement made by Mr. Miles without his receiving timely Miranda warnings. The state was erroneously permitted to introduce a DVD of the defendant's interrogation, which was replete with Detective Richardson's expression of his own opinions with respect to the strength of the state's case, Miles' credibility, and the facts. It is the function of the jury to make its own credibility determinations and to assess the state's case. In fact, this court has stated repeatedly that a police officer's opinion is not admissible. In this case,
But his questions can be. As long as they do not include opinion?
No, Hassan L. makes very clear that everything should be excised of the police officer's statements. But in our case, we don't really need to go that far because in this case there
So a statement as simple as, what is your name?
Questions, yes. Everything
that
comes up.
That should be excised.
Yes. And the state makes the argument, well, then we lose the context. But this court in Hassan L. said that argument lacks substance. But our argument today doesn't go that far because the officer made many statements that were above and beyond what was necessary.
Which gets to my question, standard of review. Are we talking about abuse of discretion here?
Yes, that is correct.
Okay.
Yes. And what happened in this case was Mr. Miles made a statement to police denying his being the shooter. Several hours later, he gave the statement, which is at issue now, where the officer obtained a statement from him saying, I did it, but I did it because the victim asked me to. Now, throughout that entire statement, the officer, and it's set forth actually in the reply brief from pages 2-5, the bulk of the officer's comments, if not all of them, he touched on the credibility of Mr. Miles, saying, you know we had you, but you were denying this, and now you're coming forth with this fake story, and comments to the effect that you knew we had the fingerprints, you knew we had this picture of you, and yet you continued to deny it, and I think you made this story, and I'm paraphrasing, I think you made this story to because I asked you to come up with something to show remorse. And if you tell us where the gun is and tell us where the clothes is, that lends credibility to your story.
Ms. Walker, I'm just trying to put myself in the place of the trial judge.
Yes.
And determine what it is that he should have done. And if I understand your position correctly, what he should have done was to strike out all of that, those long discursive paragraphs.
Yes.
Just left the answer to the question without the question.
Correct.
If he, I suppose he could have done that. Had he done that, then is it not the case, as the trial court held, that the answers would not make any sense because they would be out of context?
And that is an argument that the state makes. However, two points.
Okay, but is it at least a plausible argument?
That is a plausible argument.
Okay.
However, this court has said it lacks substance in Hassan L. and said that an argument that, well, we need the police officer statements because we need it for context. Now, as I mentioned, even though that was what was argued in the original motion, come before the court today and don't necessarily request that there be a blanket redaction, we have so many statements here that were unnecessary for context that gave opinions as to the credibility of Mr. Miles.
Well, I mean, for us to decide this issue, we would, in effect, have to do our own excising and then take a look at the answers and determine whether or not they would make sense.
Not necessarily. This court could do what it did in Holtzman versus State and in Hassan L. versus State and look at the statements and say, these are credible. The court doesn't have to go statement by statement and say these all needed to be, this line comes out, this doesn't. it can make a determination that there are statements in there. I mean, to the extent the court's going to make a determination that this goes to credibility, the court is going to make that determination, but it doesn't have to decide what the final format of the DVD is going to be.
But we're talking abuse of discretion. And isn't it the case that the party that claims that has to show precisely where the discretion was abused, which in this case means pointing out the precise text that should not have been allowed?
Yes.
There's some of that in your reply brief, but aside from that, these are basically arguments made in the abstract. And it's difficult to wrap your arms around that and under an abuse of discretion standard.
Well, respectfully, Your Honor, I don't believe it is an abstract when the opinions are set forth. The officer's opinions are very clear in the reply brief, pages 2-5, laughing at the defendant when he makes to shoot somebody for $500. Now, these are appropriate for questioning. There's no question about that. But for admissibility before a jury.
So have you, for purposes of our review, have you narrowed the scope of what we should examine to the quotations in your reply brief?
Yes, and they are pages 2-5. They're set verbatim as best as I can do from listening to the video, which is in the court's record. It is State's Exhibit 16 from the trial.
I'm sorry, tell us again. Are you talking about the excerpts that are actually in the reply brief? Or?
Yes. I'm sorry.
And in terms of the abuse of discretion standard, were these specific excerpts pointed out to the trial court, and said, look, here's a comment, or here he's laughing, or whatever, and here are our problems? Because I'm getting the impression that only, I think, two particular phrases were ever identified to the trial court.
Now, I believe you're correct. What the motion argued for everything to come out, pursuant to Hassan L. and Holtzman, which is what this court holds. Now, when they went and had the hearing, it did boil down to these two phrases, and I think the language of the defense attorney was always that these are examples. And no, he did not lay out specifically, here's further examples, and perhaps he should have, and perhaps the trial court should have asked that. And he did review, the trial court did get to see the video and looked at the video and knew himself what types of statements were being made.
Well, are you asking us to go beyond what the trial court was presented with?
No, the trial court was presented with the video, the whole video. The trial court was then asked to redact everything the officer said. When the officer knew that motion was before him and saw the video, the trial court was aware of the specifically incredible, lack of a better word, statements. The statements made by the officer with respect to credibility. So it had that before it. It had a motion, more general motion, and of course the trial court could have narrowed that, as he did, excising only one or two statements. I think he excised one statement, and then the state agreed to take two others out. So he had all this before him. And this is important because, contrary to the state's case, there is harm here. Mr. Miles made two statements. He didn't just simply make one statement confessing. He made one denying, and then he made one saying, I did it, but here's why I did it. The officer's statement goes to his credibility, basically saying, you lied then, and you're lying now, and you're making this up to cover up for this. That's what the officer's statements went to. The state attempts to say, hey, the jury bought his second statement, so there's no harm. That's not the argument he made at trial. He made an identification argument. And I know the state will argue that it's clear as day what the video said, but that's not true. The victim could not identify him from the video until after she went to the prosecutor's office and watched it, came to court, and said, that's him because I saw him in the video. So there was some merit to an identification issue in this case. They had a palm print, but he had said he'd been in the store before. And the other statement that was erroneously admitted of the other witness was, he was wearing the same clothes. I saw him wear the same clothes that day. With that issue as well, the state did not have to lay a foundation as to her statement. in that she did not touch upon the events that she perceived or to the extent of her testimony. She was asked by the officer, did you see, supposedly asked 2 days after the events, did you see Mr. Miles at work wearing the same clothes that the guy in the video was wearing? And she supposedly said yes. At trial, the prosecutor asked, do you know Mr. Miles? No. This is the witness. Did you know Mr. Miles? No. Did you recall talking to the police about Mr. Miles? Yes. Did you tell the truth? Yes. And that's all she remembered. Now, the state seems to believe that our argument is because she couldn't remember the details of her statement to police that it's not admissible. And that's the contrary. She did not testify as to the events under which the basis of the statement. She testified, she was never asked, did you see him that day? And she never said, well, I don't remember. There was no testimony whatsoever as to the underlying events. And in Keyes versus State and Jackson versus State, this court makes it very clear that in order for there to be a proper foundation, the witness has to testify as to both the underlying event and to the statement. If she had made the statement that I don't recall exactly what I said to police, and then she said I did see him that day, we'd be in a different ballpark.
Well, if someone says adamantly, I did not make a statement to the police, and denies it, then that's not a, the 3507 statement's not admissible then?
I don't believe so, because if the witness says, yeah, I gave him a statement, but I, you know, told him I lied to him, or I don't remember what I said, that's the minimum that the state has to get to in order to get it admitted. As Keyes versus State says, this is a very narrow statute. This is a significant departure from the rules of evidence, and so it needs to be interpreted narrowly. And so she said, I don't remember, but I did talk to him, and that's fine. But then she asked, do you know who Mr. Miles is? No. Never asked, did you see him that day, for her to even say, I don't remember. She was never even asked that. So there was no testimony to the underlying event.
Well, a full turncoat witness would deny the statement, deny and testify in favor of the defense in some other fashion. So is it your position that a full turncoat witness, that you cannot use a 3507 statement as a matter of law?
Well, if that's what the turncoat witness is doing, is denying there was the underlying event and the statement, then yes. I mean, that's the narrowness of the statute. However, the reality is most turncoat witnesses acknowledge talking to the police, but then either say they were lying or they say they don't remember what they said. Because, for example, Johnson versus State, that particular witness was a turncoat witness. She had told police, I overheard the defendant and the co-defendant say something. Then the police, she came to testify, and she said, I barely remember talking to police, but yeah, I did overhear something. And that was enough to be admissible. However, in Ray versus State, the witness in that case never testified to the underlying sexual abuse that had occurred. She got on the stand, wouldn't testify to the underlying event, but said, I told the police everything that happened. And this court said, that's reversible. It was not admissible. And that's the situation we're in. We're in this case where she didn't testify, wasn't even asked as to...
What about Burke, where there was amnesia?
I'm sorry?
Burke, when there was amnesia?
Well, that's forgetfulness. She never said she forgot. She said, I don't know who he is. She was never asked, do you even remember seeing him that day, for her to even say, I don't remember. No foundation questions were even asked. That's the problem here. So there was no testimony whatsoever for there to be a test of the truthfulness of that event occurring or her claims, because she made no claims. So it couldn't cross-examine her on that. I'll save the remainder of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Justice Berger, Justice Jacobs, Justice Ridgely. May it please the court. There are three issues that have been raised in this appeal. They all involve an abuse of discretion by the trial judge because they all, in one way or another, deal with evidentiary matters. The first issue concerns the second custodial statement that Tyrone Miles made to the Dover police. He was arrested the day after this shooting, September 12, 2007. He made one statement that began in the morning, 11:07 a.m., concluded at 12:53 p.m., shortly after lunch, noontime. A second statement, which is the statement at issue here, began at 5:43 p.m. and concluded, I believe, at 6:25 p.m. It was approximately 40, 42-minute statement. The statements are very different. The first statement, Mr. Miles says that while he was at the Dunkin' Depot where the shooting occurred, he was there not the day of the shooting, September 11th, but the day before, Monday, September 10th, and denied any involvement in this particular shooting. Second statement, Mr. Miles says, yes, he was there. Yes, he did shoot Ms. Patel. However, he did so because she had specifically requested that he do so and had offered him $10,000 that apparently she wanted to die, according to Mr. Miles, and he was to be paid for shooting her. So in the second statement, he certainly admits what he was convicted of, an attempted murder, and the possession of the firearm during the commission of that attempted murder. The jury...
Mr. Williams, in connection with this particular claim of error or abuse of discretion, I gather neither side disputes that there's a five-factor test that we have to apply in determining whether this defendant should have been re-Mirandized before making the second statement. My problem is with the ruling of the trial judge, who appeared to have the view that there was only one of these five factors that was problematic, and that was the time gap between the first and the second statement, giving no cognizance whatsoever to the fact that the first and second statements were entirely different from each other, and that difference is also a relevant factor. How do you respond to that?
Well, I think that's an accurate characterization of what the trial judge did. He did refer to Letta and said that the factor that he thought was of significance here was the time lapse. It's approximately, or I guess it's actually right on 5 hours between the conclusion of the first statement and the beginning of the second statement. If you go to when the Miranda warnings were issued at the beginning of the first statement, it's about 6.5 to 7 hours. That was his focus. There are five factors that are set forth in Letta, and I think Letta also cited a Pennsylvania case, and I found a more recent Maine case that also uses a five-factor test. The specific question that you're asking is the fifth factor about the difference between the statements, and I was thinking about that. And
I mean, the first statement is, I wasn't there, I didn't do it.
Correct.
The second statement was, I did it, but she paid me to do it.
Yes, and those are vastly different. But in thinking about how you apply that, it would seem to me that it's always going to arise in a circumstance where the statements are different. If the statements were really not different, and the first one was admissible because there was Miranda, and the second statement arguably may not be admissible because Miranda was not readministered, it wouldn't make any difference if they were the same because it would just be cumulative evidence. You would just admit the first statement. You wouldn't even need the second statement if it was the same. So I'm not sure how important this difference between the statements really is in reality. I think the
You're
way
saying since there would be no problem for Miranda purposes unless there was a difference between the two statements, the fifth factor should just drop out of the analysis?
I would think so, because why would you need the second statement if it wasn't Mirandized, if it's going to be virtually the same as the first statement? You would just admit the first statement. There's no Miranda issue there. So I'm not sure how really significant this fifth factor is, although admittedly it's part of the test, so I guess that's something that the trial judge can consider. In this case, however, I don't think there was any abuse of discretion by the trial judge. He focused on what I think probably is the most significant thing, is the time lapse here, the 5 to 7 hour period. There is no bright line test as to exactly when you have to readminister the Miranda warnings a second time. It's a facts and circumstances test, and looking at all of the facts and circumstances in this case, there was no indication that anything had occurred while Mr. Miles was alone in the cell block for approximately 5 hours after the conclusion of the first statement, while the police executed 3 search warrants in Dover. There's no indication of any police coercion to make a second statement. The testimony of Officer Richardson was that while he was doing the booking process at approximately 5:30, that evening, September 12, it was Mr. Miles who initiated the conversation with the officer by inquiring as to how strong the state's case was against him. And I think the officer replied that he thought he had a pretty strong case. And at some point, I guess Officer Richardson informed Mr. Miles as to what the charges were. Mr. Miles said that something to the effect that you have the wrong charges, and she was in on it. According to Mr. Richardson's testimony at the pretrial suppression hearing, Mr. Miles was eager to elaborate and to tell his side of the story, as the officer characterizes it. So that was the reason that the officer, the same officer, went back to the same interview room, which is two of the other let of factors here, is who was the interrogator and where did the subsequent interrogation take place. So in this case, I think if you look at all of the five factors, view the totality of the circumstances, that there was no abuse of discretion in admitting the second statement here. It was videotaped. The jury was able to actually see Mr. Miles while he was making the statement here. Now, the other two issues that are raised on appeal in this case concern whether or not there should have been additional redactions to the second statement beyond what the trial judge ordered. And the last issue is a 3507 evidentiary ruling issue. Those are all abuse of discretion.
In terms of the redaction issue, this has come up, I wouldn't say routinely, but it's come up quite a few times. And it always seems pretty obvious, maybe after the fact, that that although the police interrogation techniques are perfectly acceptable and can help encourage getting a more forthcoming statement or whatever, that when it comes to presenting the matter to the jury, it's a whole different set of factors to consider in terms of whether the police officer is indirectly or even directly commenting on credibility or otherwise injecting his or her own views in a way that's going to carry weight with the jury and be inappropriate. And we've said repeatedly that those kinds of comments should not be part of what goes to a jury. So it's not as if we've got an unclear legal standard here, and yet it appears that the state continues to try to push for having everything go in. Now, granted, in this case, the defense took the, you know, the opposite extreme position of saying, not no questions at all, just the defendant's statement or answers. But why should the state be jeopardizing a conviction by pushing this way for a few comments, a few snickers or comments about the weight of the evidence or how much trouble you're in or how good a case we have or things like that, when, you know, we all know that that sort of thing is not supposed to be in.
Well, I think it is a problem, and I've been thinking about it myself. We recently had a case that was briefed, and I think it's going to be argued next month before this court, Blake. And there were a multitude of 3507 statements in that case, and the trial judge held a two-day redaction hearing as to what has to come out of all these statements. It becomes a very laborious one. Fortunately, a very laborious task. Fortunately, in this case, the statement is 40 minutes, but sometimes the statements literally run for hours. What's the cleanest way? Well, I guess the cleanest way is what the defense has suggested. Just take out everything the officer says and leave what the defendant said, and those words alone come in. The practical difficulty, and I think the prosecutor and the trial judge both at least alluded to this, is that, well, that may work most of the time, but sometimes you're going to get these responses. And if the jury has absolutely no idea what the question is, it's just not going to make any sense. You have indefinite pronoun references, it, he, them. What are they talking about? And in trying to think this through, I was thinking, well, okay, if we take everything out, then what are we going to be left with? We're going to be left with the defendant's words or the witness's words in a 3507 statement.
Right, but what about just taking out everything except direct questions? And you know, kind of undisputed narratives that are, well, you know, you spoke to me yesterday. Okay, we can leave that in because there's not going to be a problem about that. You spoke to me yesterday, and you lied to me yesterday. I know you were lying to me yesterday. Well, now we're into an area where I would think everybody could recognize that, well, maybe that's a problem. And it's not really adding to an explanation of what the witness is about to say. So why couldn't it just be kind of standard procedure that the state gets its tape and looks it over, and, you know, before trial, the state and the defense counsel just X out everything except the basics of the questions and then everything the defendant said?
Well, I think that would certainly be easier. If you at least leave the questions, the jury isn't going to have to guess as to what was being said, and you're not going to have the problem in closing argument about people trying to use different portions of the statement and say, well, Mr. So-and-so said this when he was asked. Well, the jury doesn't know that he was asked that. All they know is what he
right.
said if you take everything out. So I think it's probably best to leave it to the trial judge's sound discretion. It may be a very laborious task to go through these things. And what was confronting the trial judge in this particular case was the discussion, and this was all done pre-trial because it was a pre-trial motion approximately 5 or 6 days before the trial. And they had a hearing on February 9, a day or two before the trial started, about all this. And the prosecutor at that point agreed to redact two references to Mr. Miles being in prison. And the trial judge then asked the defense counsel specifically what else he wanted redacted, since the remainder, according to the trial judge, he had seen the whole tape at that point, seemed to be quite benign, was the way the trial judge characterized it. And during this further discussion, there were three specific questions that were discussed. And the court left in two question comments or questions. One was, it looks real bad for you. And then the second one was, you thought you were doing her a favor. But the judge ordered a further redaction of a third question as to whether Mr. Miles was a hitman or not. So I think the trial judge was focusing on what was in front of him. Now, these other matters that have been raised in the reply brief, I mean, those really have to be addressed as plain error. They were not fairly presented to the trial.
Are you taking the position that, but for those specific points, the request of the written motion has been waived as to all questions? Or
no, I think they asked for that, and the trial judge they had a discussion, and I think he said, well, as a practical matter, because the trial judge was aware of Hussein L. I mean, he specifically says, well, Hussein L. says you're supposed to take it all out. But I think he also recognized as a practical matter, you may just end up engendering more confusion and solving it if you do that.
Well, what is happening as a practical matter? Are the prosecutors and defense lawyers stipulating or reaching agreement and letting statements come in, notwithstanding the holding of Hassan L.?
I don't know if it's gotten that formalized, Your Honor. I think what's happened is probably more typical of what was done in this case. A blanket motion to just exclude everything except the defendant's words or what's being filed pre-trial, and then the trial judge tries to grapple with it. And the Blake case I was referring to, the trial judge actually held a two-day hearing and systematically went through. That was a 3507 situation, but it's the same type of issue as what you have to redact out. So I think that's what they're doing. I think it's probably best to leave it to the trial judge's discretion. It would have been nice if the trial judge had a cautionary or limiting instruction as was given in Hussein L., but I think ultimately whether it's viewed as abuse of discretion, plain error, it has to be harmless error in this particular case, because whatever the judge let in was not reasonably going to change the result at trial. The jury.
When you say leave it to the trial judge's discretion, discretion to do what? To let in, to allow a question to be, for the jury to hear a question, even though the holdings of this court say the jury should not hear the question? And what's the discretion?
Well, I think the discretion has to be, if you're going to take all that out, and it's going to be confusing to the jury because you're going to have an isolated response that is not connected to anything, and it's just probably going to result in squabbles at closing argument as to what that really means, that's probably an appropriate situation to do that. I think the suggestion Justice Berger made, well, just leave the questions and let's take all the editorializing out, that's probably a more workable situation. It's going to depend, though, on the circumstances and how the examination, or the questioning, rather, of the defendant is done. Sometimes it's nice and linear and goes along a path and it's easy to follow, and other times it's random and, you know, various techniques are employed. But I think in this case, because of the strength of the case, and there was a videotape, there was a still photo, and I actually have a copy of the photo that was introduced to the jury, and it's perfectly obvious if you look at the photo that's Tyrone Miles, and the jury had this and could look at this picture and look at Mr. Miles, and okay, he's the one that committed the crime. Once his second statement was admitted, well, the jury has a statement that's what he did. He shot her because, according to him, she offered him money to do so, and he used a firearm. You can actually see the gun in the videotape. I couldn't see the victim fall, but I could see the handgun when I saw the videotape yesterday. So I think regardless of these evidentiary issues, it's harmless.
What about the third issue, the third claim of error?
The third issue was about the 3507 statement of Linda Robbins. She's a supervisor at Harris Manufacturing. Robbins recalled a detective being in the office. She was called in, I think, 2 days after the shooting, September 13. She remembered the detective asking her questions, and she thought that Mr. Richardson, who she saw at trial, was almost 17 months later, was the police officer she spoke with. When she was asked if any of the detective's questions dealt, quote, with a photograph that had been published in the state news on September 12, Robbins answered yes, and the photograph was just this picture. It appeared on the front page of the state news the day after the shooting. Robbins stated also that she had answered truthfully in 2007. She just couldn't recall exactly what it was she said in this particular situation. And the defense objection was that, well, the witness has no memory. But I think it's not really that qualitatively different than what happened in Johnson. In fact, at least in this case, the witness, the 3507 witness, recalled speaking to a police officer. In Johnson, she didn't even recall talking to the detective. So I think given the strength of the case, the fact that you can see the clothing in the pictures and the videotape, regardless of whether you have that identification or not, it's cumulative evidence and has to be harmless error under these circumstances. If there's any additional questions, I'll try to answer those. Thank you.
Thank you.
A review of Fasanelle and Holtzman makes it very clear that this court has held that the state's argument, this is a quote from Fasanelle at page 398, just a few months ago we held that the state's argument that the jury needed to see the whole videotape to understand the full context of the questioning is lacking substance. The only evidence permitted by Section 3507 is the voluntary out-of-court prior statement of the witness who is present and subject to cross-examination. While it may be laborious for the state to redact the tape, the state has got an extremely helpful to them, and if used by the defense, it would be helpful to them, exception to the rules of evidence to bring this in. So they're already way ahead of the game. The fact that they have to then redact is not, in order to protect someone's constitutional rights, is not
a what is happening as a practical matter. Is there fighting tooth and nail over every question, or are the parties agreeing to introduce the questions, even though notwithstanding the holdings of those cases? What's happening?
Yeah, I believe the stipulations between the parties is what practically is what's occurring, and so even in this case, if the court looks at the reply brief 2 through 5, we will see that the statements of the officer here were paragraphs. These were paragraphs of things he said. This wasn't a question where it was, you lied to me yesterday, you know, are you lying to me now when you, you know, in the form of a question saying, are you lying to me when you tell me the clothes are XYZ, and introduces a new concept and the defendant says yes or no. This is a paragraph. The only thing that bothers me, I mean, I can understand her setting up the robbery and so forth. What's supposed to look like a robbery, but for $500 to shoot somebody? I mean, that's not a lot. That's not a lot to shoot somebody. That's no question there. And the only other thing that bothers me is, now, I sat here earlier and read you your rights. You wanted to talk. We start talking. I thought you were getting ready to say something. And then you denied it and denied it and denied it. No question there. I mean, even after I told you what, I got your fingerprints here, you got your picture on that there, no question. None of these that I see, that I've cited, were even questions to the defendant. So
what would happen if the police officer, if there's no resources issue all the time in the world to prepare for the cases, and the police officer gives an explanation as to what, live in the from the witness stand, as to what he was asking, and then the tape is played of just the answer?
Well, that is not the procedure under 3507, but if the court were to sculpt a new way to handle this, perhaps something as far as getting a stipulation between the parties to have the, you know, just the question with the answer on the tape somehow, or have the officer say, I asked him this question for the video. Yes, you know, whatever that is. I mean,
so
it's stilted.
What you're saying is that under that procedure, the parties or the attorneys would stipulate as to what the question was.
Right, right. And I can't underscore enough that,
but absent a stipulation, could the state call the officer? What did you ask him first? I asked him his name. What did he say? They play the DVD. Is that procedure permissible as under the Constitution?
No, it's not permissible under 3507 because it's not the words of the witness.
But it's an in-court statement of the police officer.
Well, and that is a possibility. I suppose the court could craft something like that along those lines. That would be a separate principle under 3507. The way the proceedings works right now is the officer has to testify that the conversation occurred, doesn't sit on the stand during the playing of the video. So that would actually have to be a new procedure under the current 3507 and the procedures. That wouldn't be possible. And I would like to underscore the harm in this case. while it may appear to Mr. Williams or Mr. Favada or to me or to the court that that gentleman in that photo was Tyrone Miles, the question is, his defense was identification. The victim had some, there were some credibility issues with the victim's ability to actually identify him. She was the one that was there. She saw him live and in person. That's the stronger evidence with respect to identification than a still photograph. And so, therefore, the question was between, was he telling the truth when he denied it, or was he telling the truth when he said he did it? And the police officer's statements discredited him with respect to both, and so therefore there was harm in this case. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll take this matter under advisement and we'll stand in recess.